Hello, welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Luke Thompson, the host of the channel. Today I'm going to be speaking with Mahir Shahar about India in the Chinese Imagination, Myth, Religion, and Thought, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2014. Mahir Shahar co-edited this volume with John Kieschnick. In this volume, 11 scholars, including the two editors, examine the Chinese reception of Indian ideas and myth, and address Chinese attempts to recreate India within the Central Kingdom. Beginning with Victor Mayer's argument that it was Buddhist theories about reality that allowed fiction to flourish in China, and ending with Stephen Bokenkamp's study of celestial scripts that Taoists created in response to the appearance of Sanskrit and the Devanagari script in China, the volume focuses primarily on the 4th to 10th centuries, but addresses dynamics that were at play both before and after this 6th century period. While many previous studies that address the impact of India on China do so by focusing on the Chinese transformation of Buddhism and on the degree to which Chinese Buddhism retained this or that Indian feature, this volume differs in that it looks at the influence of Indian thought beyond the confines of Buddhism proper. Mahir Shahar and Bernard Faure's respective contributions are good examples of this, as they demonstrate that some of the Indian deities and demons who came to China with Tantric Buddhism exchanged their Buddhist robes for Taoist ones, or escaped into the wider world of Chinese religious thought and practice. Another central theme of the book is the way in which Chinese turned to Indian models for religious and political ends, or, in other cases, attempted to recreate India within China. Shi Jiru, for example, explains how a 10th century king of Wuyue sought to manufacture and distribute 84,000 stupas, a clear emulation of the great Indian king Ashoka. In addition to the aforementioned scholars, the volume contains chapters by Yamabe Nobuyoshi, Ye Derong, the late John McRae, Robert Scharf, and Kristen Mollier. This book will be of particular interest to those wanting to learn more about Indian myth in East Asia, the Chinese reception of Indian ideas and symbols, the interaction between Taoism and Buddhism, the adapting of Buddhist monasticism to Chinese familial organization, Bodhidharma, the influence of Buddhism on Chinese literature, and the Chinese response to Buddhist doctrinal dilemmas.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. Today I'm with Mahir Shahar to talk about India in the Chinese Imagination, Myth, Religion, and Thought, a book he co-edited with John Kieschnick and which was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2014. Mahir Shahar is professor of Chinese Studies in the Department of East Asian Studies at Tel Aviv University. His research focuses primarily on the interplay between Chinese religion and literature, the history of Chinese martial arts, Chinese esoteric Buddhism, and the influence of Indian mythology on Chinese deities and thought. He is the author, co-editor, or translator of 6 books in both English and Hebrew. Mahir Shahar, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you very much.
So as is usual for the show, I was wondering if you could just begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself, where you're from, and how you came to the study of China.
So as you know, I'm Israeli. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised in Jerusalem. And I think I chose Chinese studies as a major, as an undergraduate at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, not because I knew anything about China, but because I knew nothing. Mm. I wanted an adventure. I wanted to learn, to study a culture with which I was not familiar. I will perhaps mention and give honor to my parents. My father, he passed away several years ago, was a novelist. His name was David Shahar, and he wrote novels in Hebrew. And my mother, I wish her many more years of happiness and productivity. My mother is a historian, Shulamit Shahar, a medieval historian, a historian of Christian Europe. Mm-hmm. So as I grew up around the dinner table, I heard a lot about Judaism and Hebrew literature and European history. So I can't say I'm an expert, but I heard about it. I'm familiar, I guess. And just because I'm familiar with European culture or Jewish culture or Hebrew culture, I found it boring. I wanted something, you know, I wanted to learn something I know nothing about. I wanted an adventure. So I chose the furthest thing from Israel of the time that I could think of, which was China. In other words, I haven't read the Analects as a boy, being influenced and decided to learn about China. Uh-huh. And I think I never met a Chinese person. Before college, I never met a Chinese person. Mm. So I chose it, you know, just because it was very far away.
I see.
And And I can tell you a funny memory I have. You know, in Israel, we do the army before going to college.
Right.
So I made this decision. I had this idea that I want to study China and then later travel to China during my last year of military service. And I took a day off from the army and went to the Hebrew University to audit a class. Mm-hmm. A class on China. And so it happened that the day I arrived to the university, there was a professor there. His name was Vitaly Rubin. He was a Jew from Russia, an emigre, a recent emigre to Israel. He came from Russia to Israel, and he was an expert on Confucianism. And I audited this class, I entered this class, and there was only one student there, one Israeli student, and myself, the soldier, I came, you know, and the professor. And his Hebrew was not very good. He just came to Israel. And he had on the desk, he had the Analects in Russian and in Chinese, and he had it in Hebrew. Someone translated the Analects into Hebrew many years before.
Wow.
So in fact, and so he was reading it in these three languages, and I realized that as I was sitting there, that in fact he was learning Hebrew during the class. Yeah. He was using the student, the other student in the class, and myself, the guest, to learn Hebrew. He was learning Hebrew through the Hebrew translation of the Analects with which he was familiar.
Wow.
So anyway, he was a great scholar, but that was my first encounter with Chinese studies.
Wow, great. So how did you come to focus specifically on Chinese perceptions of India and Indian myth, thought, and religion in China? Since this following began as a conference, a better question might be why or how did you come to gather a group of scholars together for the purpose of addressing these questions, the sort of...
Sure. I think I'll tell you when I was an undergraduate at the Hebrew University and I was taking courses on China, so what we were really usually taught, you know, you begin with Confucianism, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And I admire Confucianism like all of us. It's a great ethical system. But I confess I never found it very attractive or very, how should I put it? At the same time that I was studying China and Confucianism, I was taking courses at the Hebrew University with a great scholar of Indian studies. His name is David Shulman. Mm-hmm. He's a great expert on Indian mythology, especially on Indian literature of southern India in Tamil and Telugu. And I was taking these courses with him. They were minor, not my major. And I always found India more interesting than China. I was even contemplating leaving Chinese studies and going to Indian studies because Indian myth seemed to me so fascinating. I mean, the Indian, it seemed to me that the Indians dare write what we don't dare dream.
Mm.
Such as this voluptuous world of the supernatural, all these gods and demons and the outrageous adventures they have and libido, you know, the sex of the Indian god is so striking.
Mm.
So I was very interested in India. And it took me many years to find in China the same fascinating world of the imagination. For example, in novels such as Journey to the West, the novel Journey to the West, you know, it's so, mm-hmm. such a fascinating novel with so many demons and gods. And of course, it took me many years before I encountered the living Chinese popular religion, before I, you know, started visiting Chinese temples in Taiwan, and I was really struck by all these statues of the gods. So it took me many years before I was convinced that China is as interesting as India,
mm.
for me personally. I guess after many years, you know, I wrote about the Chinese martial arts, I wrote a book about the Shaolin Temple and about the Chinese gods. And finally, this project really brings together my two loves, the love of Indian culture, which I harbored since my undergraduate years, mm-hmm. with David Shulman, and the love of China. And as it happens, my co-editor, who's also my good friend, John Kishnick, as you know, he wrote a magnificent book called The Impact of Buddhism on Chinese Material Culture. He had been very interested in the role of Buddhism in bringing Indian civilization to bear upon Chinese culture in general, not on Chinese Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
but Chinese material culture. You know, I'm sure you read his book. So, for example, even the fact that Chinese are sitting on chairs rather than crouching on mats, this is because of Buddhism, or tea. We assume that tea is such a Chinese thing, but actually the culture of drinking tea was introduced to China by Indian Buddhist monks. So he came to it, to this project, from the impact of Buddhism or of Indian culture through Buddhism on Chinese material culture. I was interested in the impact of the Indian supernatural through the vehicle of Buddhism on Chinese religion, on Chinese literature, how the gods were transmitted from India to China. And we started talking about it, and we arranged a conference. We brought many scholars who were interested in broadly in the way India influenced the Chinese creative imagination, not only Buddhism, but Chinese literature at large, Chinese Taoism, Chinese popular religion at large. In other words, the book is not concerned only with how Buddhism was transmitted from India to China, but rather the role of Buddhism in bringing Indian civilization at large to influence Chinese civilization at large. So these are some of the scholars we brought. Others were more concerned in the way in which the Chinese recreated India within China's borders. So the Chinese were so fascinated by India that they brought India to China. I will give just one, if you allow me, one small example. I'm not sure it is even mentioned in the book. There is, you know, in China a city called Hangzhou, and Hangzhou was a very important city with many temples, many Buddhist temples, and there is a magnificent small mountain outside of the city. The mountain is called Fei Lai Feng, meaning literally the mountain that came flying. This is what the name means in Chinese. And this mountain is in fact the Great Harakuta, the very mountain on which in India the Buddha preached the famous sutras of the Mahayana, or many of them.
So that's Chinese. That's Vulture Peak.
Yes, the Vulture Peak, exactly. The Great Harakuta is the Vulture Peak. So in fact, the Chinese, they identified the sacred geography of India within their own borders. A little bit like New York, yes, where you are sitting at the moment, which is like York in England, in America. So the Chinese transferred India into China. This, by the way, happens also with the Indian gods. If I give just one example, Vaishravana, or Kubera, he has several names in Sanskrit. He's a very important god in Hinduism, and then a god indeed in Indian Buddhism. He was identified in China with a historical Chinese general called Li Jing, who was probably a devotee. The historical Li Jing, Chinese Li Jing, was probably a devotee of this Indian god. But what we find in later Chinese literature is that the Indian god, the Chinese general, is identified as an incarnation of the Indian gods. So what we see is, both geographically and in terms of the gods, they were all relocated to China, identified with Chinese figures, or relocated geographically to China. So I guess that's what the volume is, broadly speaking, about.
Sure. So the book contains 10 chapters, and each one is by a different scholar, and the chapters are grouped under three headings, or divided into three sections. And all this is preceded by an introduction written by John Kishnick and you, I assume. The first question I want to ask before we get into the content of the book itself is just whether you envision this book as part of a longer tradition of the study of Indian influence on China.
Definitely, yes. The book stands in a long scholarly tradition that that concerns the impact of India on China. I'll perhaps take a moment here to say something that is probably obvious to you and to the listeners, but is still striking to me. Nowadays, China is a superpower. And I guess nowadays, that's at least my impression from the Indian press when I visited India, the Indians are looking up to China. They hope to be as strong as China, yes. China is the yardstick by which contemporary Indians measure their own development. I think perhaps I'm wrong. China is so big, so strong. India is trying to catch up. But it is interesting that historically speaking, India has had a tremendous impact upon China. whereas it is unclear at all whether China ever influenced India. Even think about, you know, basic things like translation. We know thousands upon thousands of Sanskrit scriptures or Pali scriptures or scriptures in Indian languages that were translated into Chinese, and they influenced every aspect of Chinese lives, from mathematics and linguistics, material culture, literature, fiction. And it is not clear whether ever any Chinese book was translated into an Indian language.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there is a tradition that Xuanzang, the Chinese monk, was ordered by the Chinese emperor to translate the Tao Te Ching, the Taoist scripture, into Sanskrit. This is recorded in Chinese writings. But whether he did accomplish this translation, and whether this translation ever made it to India, is unclear. So, in fact, India influenced China rather than China influencing India, historically.
Right.
And the book is, of course, part of this tradition. I guess what is unique about it, or what we've tried to do, is, as I've already said, is examine the role, the influence, not only in terms of Buddhism, but more broadly upon the Chinese creative arts, the influence of Indian literature through the vehicle of Buddhism on Chinese literature, fiction, on Chinese popular religion, on Chinese Taoism, and also to see how the Chinese tried to recreate, reimagine, or imitate India within their own borders. How they reinvented India in China. I guess that these are the two main issues.
Sure. Thanks. So the first section of the book is entitled Indian Mythology and the Chinese Imagination. And this section, you write, explores the place of Indian gods and stories about them in Chinese literature. The chapter that you wrote appears in this section and focuses on the Chinese deity Nezha.
Is that Nezha? Yes.
Nezha. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and his Indian origins. So I was wondering. I wanted to start here, and I was wondering if you could please tell us who this deity was, first of all, and secondly, how you go about tracing this deity to India.
Yes. So the god Nezha is a very, very interesting god. He is among the most popular gods in contemporary China, and his myth is among the most well-known in Chinese literature. It is retold in oral literature and television series and movies and cartoons, not only in China but also in Japan, where he is known as Nataku. And the story is very interesting. According to the legend, this Nezha tried to kill his father. It is a strikingly Oedipal myth, which is very interesting because we are always told that filial piety is the most important Chinese virtue. And yet here we have a god, a very popular god, who defied this Confucian ethics, who very blatantly tried to kill his father, and yet his cult is very popular. Mm-hmm. So the figure of Nezha is very interesting from a Freudian perspective,
mm-hmm.
and this is something I explore in a book of mine that is forthcoming later this year in the summer. The book is called Oedipal God, and in it I deal with this Oedipus complex in Chinese literature. But the essay in this book, in the Indian Chinese Imagination, concerns the origin of Nezha,
mm-hmm.
and it turns out that, like many other Chinese gods, many, he's originally an Indian god. Nezha is not a Chinese name. Nezha is a shortened and corrupt Chinese transcription of an Indian name. The original Indian name is Nalakubala. It was translated into medieval Chinese as Nezha Jubalo, and this was shortened into Nezha, and Nezha later became Nezha. And in the book I show or demonstrate this evolution from the original Sanskrit name to the Chinese name. So he's a figure of the Indian imagination, and he was brought to China along with his father, whom I mentioned earlier. His father is Vaishravana or Kubera. He was brought to China by esoteric Buddhism. If you want, I can elaborate a little more about esoteric Buddhism and its role in bringing in bringing Indian mythology to bear upon Chinese culture. So I'm straying sideways a little bit to talk about esoteric Buddhism
in China.
So, as you know, esoteric Buddhism or Tantric Buddhism is a very interesting phase in the evolution of the Buddhist faith. And, of course, Tantric Buddhism is very important in Tibet. We all know it. Tibetan Buddhism is essentially Tantric Buddhism. And we also know that Tantric Buddhism is very important in Japan, where we have established schools, Shingon and also Tendai. These are Tantric schools. But somehow scholars until recently thought that esoteric Buddhism didn't influence China. And the reason this perception was based upon the fact that in China there is no organized esoteric Buddhist school. There is nothing in China like Shingon in Japan or like Tendai in Japan. So somehow the assumption was that Tantric Buddhism passed through China on its way to Japan. Obviously it passed through China. I mean, that's how it made it to Japan, through China. But somehow in China, it left no trace. But we are becoming increasingly aware that, in fact, esoteric Buddhism has had a tremendous impact on China. I will pay credit here to Michel Strickman. Michel Strickman was, I think, the first Western scholar in recent decades to pay attention to this, that in fact esoteric Buddhism did influence China, but it didn't influence China by way of an organized school, but rather tantric deities and tantric ritual practices permeated Chinese religion and Chinese literature. For example, I'll give just one example, possession. We have in tantric literature detailed description of rituals of possessions that are called avesha. And in these rituals, the tantric master summons the god or the ghost into the body of a child. For example, if you have a sick person, a sick person is lying on his sick bed, and so the tantric master comes to heal him. So how does he heal the sick person? I'm sorry if I'm rambling too much.
No, not at all.
So how does he cure the patient? He brings a small child, and the small child stands by the bed. And then the tantric master orders the inflicting demon of disease to exit the body of the patient and enter the body of the child. And he interrogates him. interrogates the demon of disease, and once he gets his identity clear, once the identity and the name of the inflicting demon is clarified, he exorcises it. He exorcises the demon. So the process of tantric possession involves a master and a child. Now, if we look at contemporary Chinese popular religion, we find that the Chinese mediums are always referred to as children. Even if they might be 80 years old, but they're called children. And this was already suggested by Michel Strickman, the process by which they become possessed has been fashioned after tantric ritual.
I see.
So in fact, tantric ritual has had a big impact on Chinese popular religion, on rituals of possession. Now, what I'm interested in, Michel Strickman was also interested in it, is the role of Tantric Buddhism in bringing Indian gods to China. One characteristic of Tantric Buddhism, as distinguished from earlier schools of Buddhism, or to be more accurate, to a greater extent than earlier schools of Buddhism, Tantric Buddhism adopted practically all Indian gods, whether or not they were Buddhist. So Shiva and Vishnu and the entire family, this strange family of Shiva. He has, a son with an elephant head, Ganesha, and another son, Skanda. So all of the gods of Indian, what we now call Hinduism, not only Buddhist gods, but Hindu gods, were brought to China by esoteric Buddhism. And nowadays we find them in Taoism and in the popular religion. And one example is this Nerja. Nerja was brought to China by esoteric Buddhism, and this, by the way, can be clearly seen by the god's iconography. Indian gods, Hindu gods originally, they are often multi-limbed, multi-headed, Very fascinating creatures. They have three heads and nine arms, and each arm holds a different weapon, yes?
Right.
So when you look upon Nerja in China, you discover that he's multi-limbed, multi-headed. The city of Beijing, what we now call Beijing, during the Yuan period in the 13th and 14th century, it was called Dadu. The city of Beijing has 11 gates. And these 11 gates were identified in the 13th and 14th century with the three heads, six arms, and two legs of the god Nerja. So Beijing was in fact called Nerja City or Nalakubara City. So here you have really a striking example of the impact of the Indian imagination on China. The Chinese named their capital after a multi-headed, multi-armed Indian god that was brought to China from India. And the other essays in this part of the book of our India and the Chinese imagination, the essay by Victor Meir. Victor Meir is really, you know, we should pay him his dues. He's one of the first Western scholars to repeatedly argue for the impact of India on Chinese literature. The impact of Indian literature on Chinese literature. He argues, you know, one, we may quibble with this or that argument of his, but broadly, I think he's correct. Indian literature has had a liberating impact on Chinese writing.
Yeah.
Chinese writing prior to the arrival of Buddhism was mainly historical. The Chinese were, and he argues this in this book, in our book, the Chinese were obsessed with the writing of history. What they wrote was always supposed to be historically accurate. And I always tell my students, if you allow me, can I go on?
Yes, please. Yeah, I was going to go on to the Victor Meir chapter. So.
Yeah, so I always tell my students that, as it were, Chinese literature broadened the horizons of the Chinese creative imagination. For example, time-wise, the Chinese imagined things that occurred, they were confined to human history. Essentially, a few thousand years back, and the foreseeable future, you know, what happened 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, the legendary emperors, and a little bit into the future. But in India, time is measured not by human lives, by eons, yes? Kalpa or an eon. And a eon, you know, is the time that it takes a bird to scratch the Himalayas until they no longer exist, yes? A bird that alights on the Himalaya and each time scratches a little bit of dirt. So an eon is the time it will take it to scratch the entire Himalayas into a plateau. So time became much larger in the Chinese imagination. Space as well. In China, broadly speaking, space was the lands around China, yes? Perhaps a few islands of the immortals to the east, legendary mountains to the west, but the recognized universe. But in India, they imagined all of these universes, each with a Buddha, countless, numberless cosmoses, you know, each with its own Buddha, its own hell, its own paradise. So space was enlarged. And finally, possibilities. As Victor Meir argues correctly, bien, that is transformation, the ability of the Indian gods to transform themselves, to assume at will any shape they like. The Indian gods can appear as female or male, as human or animal. They can change their form. So this really liberated the imagination of Chinese authors. In fact, Victor Meir goes further than that. He argues that the very idea of fiction, that is to say, of a story that is consciously not real or not true in the historical sense, a story that one creates from his own or her own imagination. This very idea of fiction, he argues, came to China from India. So you might say that he's exaggerating a little bit, that in China, you know, we have poetic pieces of the imagination prior to the arrival of Buddhism.
Yes.
But still, I think that there's something to this argument. India did influence Chinese literature very deeply, as he argues.
Yes. So, right. So he seems to be linking it even to this Buddhist doctrine of emptiness and the notion that the world is but an illusion. So products of the mind are almost ontologically equal to, they have the same ontological status as things we see in front of us. Right?
Well, exactly as you have said. Well, the world itself is an illusion or a dream dreamt by some divine creature. Then it is as true as whatever we dream and whatever we write down.
So I just want to ask one other question before moving on, and that's that. So you're saying that it, in part it was the Indian Indian sort of imagination about time and so forth that so attracted or maybe impressed the Chinese. The Chinese are thinking in terms of thousands of years, and as you say, the you know, the sort of Indian ideas of time are just so much more expansive. But when it comes specifically to Indian deities, and this is something that Bernard Ford touches on in his chapter 2, is it also this sort of Indian imagination when it comes to deities that attracted Chinese to the Indian pantheon that came with Buddhism?
I think so. I will allow myself to tell you a little bit about my daughter. And this is related to your field of research because you are a Japanese expert. My daughter is 14 years old, and like many, many young people, young persons all over the world, she's fascinated by Japanese anime and manga.
Uh-huh.
Yes? She watches online all of these Japanese serials, these cartoons, these animated movies, and then she goes with her friend to these cosplay. Do you know this thing? This
sure.
cosplay.
Sure.
They go to this cosplay and they dress up like these characters from the Japanese movies. So in other words, my daughter's, her name is Orit Lutau. So my daughter's mind is filled with creatures of the Japanese imagination.
Uh-huh.
And they influence her life. They influence the way she dresses. They influence her social life. She paints. She herself goes on painting these anime. And I think that something like that happened to the Chinese during the Chinese Middle Ages. They were suddenly exposed to this plethora of this endless world of Indian mythological creatures that were in every respect fascinating to the Chinese visually. They were so interesting with all these heads and arms and each Indian god is associated with a mount, with an animal mount. He or she may ride a bird or a cow or a bull, yes, or a lion, and they have all this assorted weaponry and jewelry. So visually, the gods were fascinating to the Chinese, and not only visually, also the legends and stories about them,
mm-hmm.
and their powers, their supernatural powers, their ability to transform themselves. So I think this had a great impact on the Chinese, not only gods, but also demons. These frightening creatures of the Indian imagination, they lurk in Chinese popular religion and Chinese literature all the way to the present.
Yeah. So moving on to the second section, we don't have time, obviously, to address every chapter in the book, but the second of the three sections in the book is entitled India in Chinese Imaginings of the Past. And this section, you write, explores how Chinese authors deeply concerned with history attempted to fit Indian history and particularly Indian Buddhist history into their conception of the past. So I wanted to talk about chapter 5 a little bit by Shijiru. And
mm-hmm.
And in this chapter, she focuses on the 10th century manufacturing of 84,000 miniature stupas by one particular king, a king of Wuyue, one of the kingdoms of the Five Dynasties and Ten Kingdoms period. And this act was based on the legendary actions of the Indian Buddhist king Ashoka. Now, of course, there's a debate as to whether Ashoka really was a Buddhist and so forth, but none of that's relevant here since it's our only concern is the Chinese perceptions of Ashoka. And it seems to me that two of the main points here are that this king, Jianshu, asked, used Buddhism as an alternative source of legitimacy, alternative to the Chinese imperial system, that is, and also that She addresses the symbolism of kingship and shows that on the one hand, he was modeling Ashoka, but on the other hand, was also borrowing from Chinese sort of symbolism connected with kingship. So I was wondering if you could just talk about this chapter a bit.
Yes, I think it's a wonderful chapter. I think that all the chapters in the book are wonderful, and this is one of them. You're absolutely right. You pinpointed the main issues in this chapter. What we see here is that, if you want, again, first of all, you see here an attempt by the Chinese to recreate an Indian legend, or an attempt by a Chinese king to emulate an Indian king, as this king has been portrayed in Buddhist scriptures. So there is an attempt here. So it's very striking. It's not only religious influence. It is also a political influence. An attempt, Indian kingship becomes a model for Chinese kingship, for the Chinese idea of government. And the Chinese ruler is trying to emulate an Indian ruler, or is trying to tap the authority of an Indian ruler to justify his own kingship over China, over part of China. And this is done by the issue of the 84,000 stupas, because Ashoka was supposed to build 84,000 stupas, so the Chinese king tried to do the same thing. What is interesting, or among the interesting things from a religious perspective, is that according to the Indian legend, the stupas contained bodily relics. They contained the flesh or bones or what was left, or hairs of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. Whereas in China, these stupas, the 84,000 stupas, and apparently he did produce this number of stupas, the Chinese king, these stupas contained not bodily relics, but their equivalent, that is to say, sacred Buddhist scriptures that were printed in China. This is related to the invention of printing in China.
Yes.
By the way, this is also again related to esoteric Buddhism, because the texts that were enshrined in these little stupas, these texts are really tantric mantras or tantric dharanis that were supposed to be as sacred and as religiously efficacious as the bodily relics of the Buddha himself. So if you want, the Chinese were using their technology, their new technology of printing, to do what the Indian king had done previously.
Mm-hmm.
And they were replacing the bodily relics with the printed texts. But clearly, you see here an attempt to recreate India within Chinese borders, to relive or redo what an Indian king had done.
Right. One of the things in the chapter that I really liked too was the when there's this discussion of the gilt stupas that the king made, and they had these four jataka scenes on the four sides, and Shijiru suggests that these correspond to the four important pilgrimage sites in northern India. And she writes, engraving the Jataka scenes on the stupa thus transforms the artifact into a portable microcosm of Buddhist India. And then also, through the scenes of bodily sacrifices from the Buddha's past lives, because all these scenes were of the Buddha sort of sacrificing his own body, the stupa in effect becomes the Buddha's body, or more accurately, bodies.
So. Yes. Yes. So the stupa is really, so there's no need to go to India anymore. There's no need to go on a pilgrimage to India when you have such a stupa at home in China.
Mm. So moving on to the next chapter in the section, which is addresses the Shaolin Temple, which obviously you've written about. In this chapter, Ye De Rong, is that the, he looks at, he argues that major monasteries in pre-modern China constructed monastic family lines on the order, in line with the model of the Chinese family.
Yes, yes. In fact, I think that this essay by him is really unique and is really an important contribution to Chinese Buddhist scholarship. I don't think that any Western scholar has written about this or has shown what he is showing. By the way, it's an opportunity for me to thank him. He helped me a lot in my own research on the Shaolin martial arts. Yederong is really, I guess, the leading expert in China on the Shaolin monastery, the Shaolin monastery contains hundreds of steles. And steles with inscriptions, and I think no one in China knows these inscriptions better than him. So he helped me immensely when I was writing my book on the Shaolin Monastery. What he does in this essay, which I think no one has done it, is to show that the Chinese monasteries or the Chinese monastic institutions were modeled after the Chinese family. Firstly, in terms of the vocabulary. And the filial piety values that accompany this vocabulary. So your disciples were your sons, filial sons, and their disciples were your grandsons, your filial grandsons, and your brother, the someone who studied with you under the same master, his students were his filial sons, and they were your filial nephews, yes? So the vocabulary of the Chinese family was transferred into the monastic organization. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. The other thing that he shows is something that we usually don't think about. We always think about this idea of the master who chooses a student from among the hundreds he might have, and he bestows upon him the bowl and the robe, yes?
Yeah.
The symbols. Yeah, he chooses the brightest student, the student that grasps the teaching, and he bestows upon him the symbols of authority.
Right.
He is my student, he is qualified to teach. But what Yederong argues is that, in fact, this whole thing of the transmission of the Dharma was very rare, if it ever happened. For the overwhelming majority of Chinese monks, they never experienced this good fortune of a master bestowing upon them his robe or his bowl. It never existed, really. What really counted was the family tree that has been fashioned after the Chinese family, and it determined the managerial positions and the rights for the property of the temple. So, in fact, the Shaolin temple and the Shaolin branch temples, it was always very clearly marked who was the descendant of whom and who was the senior descendant of whom, and just like the elder son in the family, that person would be appointed as the manager, yes. And he will have the authority to regulate the economic activities of the temple. So the entire monastic organizations, in terms of authority, managerial authorities, economic power, was modeled after the Chinese family. And Yederong argues that this is something new to China.
I see.
But yes.
Yeah. Okay. In the interest of time, because I want to ask you about the editing process too, but I, in the interest of time, I think we only have time to look at just one more of the 10 chapters, but I wanted to mention Stephen Bokenkamp's chapter, because I thought this was something I wasn't aware of. In his chapter, being chapter 10, Bokenkamp shows how the Chinese encounter with Sanskrit drove some Taoists to create their own sacred scripts.
This is a fascinating chapter, yes.
And he also he notes in the beginning of the chapter that originally for the conference, I suppose, he was thinking of sort of continuing in the sort of spirit of Eric Zurcher's, continuing an examination of the Chinese reception of certain Buddhist and Indian concepts and maybe rituals, and looking at sort of how these were transformed in China. But he concludes by suggesting that what made the greatest impression on Chinese was not necessarily the various ideas and so forth that came with Buddhism, but you know, the language itself. So I was wondering if you could just tell us about this chapter.
Yeah, it's really a wonderful chapter, I think. What Stefan Bokenkamp is arguing is that somehow the trapping of foreign language add a mystique to the Buddhists in China. they had a sort of a sacred, mysterious language that only they knew, that only they controlled. This was Sanskrit, with very strange sounds and strange way of writing, yes? And I guess this, as it works in religions often, what you don't understand has power, yes? Characters that you don't understand, the more mysterious, obscure, unintelligible something is, the more religiously potent it is, the more magic power it possesses. So what he argues that the Taoists attempted to create their own language, their own divine language, in imitation of Sanskrit.
Mm.
They created a language that didn't exist really. They called it a heavenly script or a heavenly language. And then they, what is really funny, they also copied or imitated the Chinese Buddhist methods of translating this language. Mm-hmm. So just as the Chinese monks had teams of translators working and translating Sanskrit scriptures into Chinese, so the Taoists created this divine language that gave them authority, divine authority, and then they created teams of gods, actually, who translated this divine language into ordinary Chinese.
Mm.
So it's really a striking example of how the Sanskrit figured in the Chinese imagination. How they attempted to invent another language like it, another religious language like Sanskrit.
Yeah. So I wanted to go on now, and we haven't covered all the chapters, but that will be a reason for listeners to look the book up themselves and go get a copy. But I wanted to ask a few questions now about the editing process. Now, because I assume that most of the people listening to this podcast are involved in academia themselves somehow, and thus might be interested to know how one goes about managing a bunch
sure.
of unruly scholars, each of whom may be entirely convinced that he or she is right. I'm being a bit facetious, but I would like to know whether in the role of editor you try to steer the author's respective chapters in this or that direction, and whether you got involved with issues of style and so forth.
Yeah. Okay. Before I answer your question, before I address specifically the issue of whether or not we try to shape the essays or steer the authors in a certain direction, I'll just say that editing a book is, I hope my English is right, you may correct me, is a hassle, yes? It's a very tiring process because, as you know, publishing your own book is very tiring.
Mm.
You have to send it to the publisher, and you have to find an editor who is interested, and then he sends it to readers, and you have to be hopeful that the readers like your manuscript, and then you have to take care of their suggestions, and then you resend it, and then there is copy editing, and then there are proofs, and it's a very lengthy process. It's hundreds of emails going back and forth, yes. So, or with many emails going back and forth.
Right.
So when you are editing a book, it's much harder because first of all, you have to deal with all the authors. You have to make sure that each one send you his chapter on time, and then that they send the revisions on time, and then that they go according to the guidelines, and then they take care of the proofs, and so many technical things. And then you have to deal with the press, and what happens is, usually, you send it to the publisher, and then he, if you're lucky, he sends it to readers, and then one reader likes essays 1, 3, and 5, but says that essays 2, 4, and 6 are useless. He suggests dropping them. And then the other reader says that essays 2, 4, and 6 are magnificent, but essays 1, 3, and 5 are really off the mark. Yeah.
Wow.
You should get rid of them. So you have to deal with this as well. So in light of this difficulty, the key thing is you must have a very good friend as your co-editor. And I was incredibly lucky to have John Kishnick as my co-editor. First of all, he's a wonderful editor. I mean, his English is magnificent, and he's a very skilled editor. He edited Asia Major for many years. But then we really worked harmoniously together, so this is my great luck. I'll perhaps add I don't know if you would like it. You know what? I will add now something, and we'll talk later whether we want to edit it out, okay?
Okay.
You and me. And this is when we published the book, and the publisher, which was extremely nice and very helpful, the University of Pennsylvania Press, we were really lucky with them. They were really nice, and they did a wonderful job. They told us the number of words in the book, yes?
Mm-hmm.
We, you know how it is. They give you a limit.
Yeah.
I mean, we gave them a rough estimate. They gave us a limit. It turned out that we didn't count the glossary and the notes or, you know, and the book turned out to be much larger than originally planned. So they said, you know, you just have to cut. And there was so much to cut. So we started thinking about it. If we ask each author to cut one-fifth of his essay, you know, it just doesn't end.
Right.
You know, and the authors are reluctant to cut. So eventually John gave up his own chapter.
Wow.
Gallantly. If you notice, it's a very curious thing. The book is India and the Chinese Imagination, edited by John Kishnick and Meir Shahar, but there is no John Kishnick essay inside.
Yeah.
And the reason is simply because he gallantly, we reached a point in which after, you know, communicating with all the authors and with the press and making various suggestions for limit, there was no way around it. We had to drop one essay. So he gallantly chose to drop his own.
Oh, that's kind of him.
So, anyway,
yeah.
That's the story.
Well,
that's the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, but now more specifically to your question about steering, we didn't make, okay, I think that we did make two decisions. First of all, we didn't drop any essay, with the exception of John's essay, mm-hmm. which I just mentioned. In other words, we were not willing to accept readers who said, you know, that essay is not good.
I see.
We insisted that once we communicated with authors and had their essays on the volume, we don't disappoint any author.
Right.
This we indeed did do. And I think we didn't make a big effort to steer them or force them too much into what we had in mind.
Yeah.
I think that we did give them freedom. I'm convinced, for this interview, I looked again at the volume, and I see that the essays are all very good, each one in its own right.
Yes.
Whether or not they perfectly match each other or, you know, go together in the way we would have hoped.
Right.
So we went with the authors.
Yeah.
We didn't force them to change anything.
Right. I see.
So, yeah.
And when you because the book is divided into these three sections, were these themes that you could sort of had set up for the conference initially?
Yes, and I think we did have it in the conference initially, and then it went well. The essays fitted, so we kept it. Yes,
I see. Okay, thanks for that. So before we move on to the end of the interview, I just wanted to note that the book is dedicated to John McRae, who has a chapter in the book, but who passed away during the, I guess, before the...
Yes.
Yeah, before the book was published.
That's true. He did participate in the conference. The conference was held in Tel Aviv, and it was a wonderful conference. Also, you know, we traveled together to Jerusalem, yes, and John was there, and he was healthy, and he was fine. And then, I guess, a year after the conference, he became ill,
yes.
And the book is dedicated to him. You know that his partner is Jean Nattier.
Right.
Jean Nattier is a great scholar of Buddhist studies, and and she's a very good friend of all of us as well. And it was important for us to dedicate the book to his memory.
Mm. So, as a final question, I wanted to ask you what you're working on now. You had mentioned. And also, I wanted you to mention your book that we had discussed briefly before we started the interview.
Yeah, so I've already finished a book titled "The Oedipal God: The Chinese Nerja and His Indian Origins," and the book is concerned with Nerja, about whom I have an essay in this volume. But the book is concerned not only with his Indian origins, but mostly with his myth and cult in China. And it is an occasion, because this myth is such a striking Oedipal myth, I try to examine the question of the Oedipus complex in Chinese literature and the way the Oedipus complex works in China with filial piety.
I see.
I try to argue that, in a way, many Chinese Oedipal tales masquerade as tales of filial piety.
Hmm.
In other words, violence is hidden. Familial violence is hidden under a facade of filial behavior.
I see.
That's what I thought. Now, the other project I'm now beginning, is a project on the Chinese tutelary deity, you may find it funny, of horses, donkeys, and mules, of equine animals. He was called the horse king in Chinese Ma Wang, and I discovered that his cult was really prevalent in late Imperial China. That is to say, as long as Chinese relied on equine animals, horses, donkeys, and mules as principal draft animals.
Yes.
In agriculture, and for plowing, for milling, merchants relied on horses, mules, and donkeys to transport merchandise, and the military. The Chinese military was mounted. The elite units of the Manchu army, they were mounted. So they were cavalrymen. So the horse king was tremendously important, and all of these groups worshipped the horse king. So it's a book about the horse king. What is interesting about this horse king, and that's related to the current project, is that like Nerja, the horse king was originally an Indian god who was brought to China by esoteric Buddhism. Mm. You may be familiar with the horse-headed Guanyin, the horse-headed Avalokiteshvara.
Yes.
One of the striking apparitions of Avalokiteshvara is with a horse head. It's called Mato in Chinese. I think Bato in Japanese.
Yeah, Bato.
And in fact, the Chinese horse king, that's what I'm trying to argue, was his Tantric and Buddhist origins were entirely forgotten during the late Imperial period. Huh. But I argue that he is, in fact, Avalokiteshvara, the horse-headed Avalokiteshvara. So it's a book about... I hope that the book will bring to life also the ecology of the horse,
huh,
or of equine animals during the late Imperial period in China.
So this project the temporal focus to be the late Imperial period?
I guess it would be. I don't know what. I'll tell you one thing, one small thing. Ye De Long, the one who has an essay in the current volume, and he's a good friend of mine. He, if you don't mind, I'll tell you a small story. He several years ago found in an antique market in Beijing a sachet of manuscripts, a bundle of manuscripts from a horse king temple in Shanxi, in northwest China. These are the account books of a horse king temple. Over 100 years, that is to say, they go from 1850 to the 1950s, to the land reforms, when the pen drops in the middle of the notebook. You can see the date on which the temple was destroyed, yes?
Wow.
And it's very interesting. What is very funny about these notebooks is that you see that the villagers gave money to the temple according to the number of horses or donkeys or mules in their possession.
All right.
It's an account book, so it's very clear. Each villager, they count the number of horses in the village and donkeys and mules, and people are expected to donate money according to the number of equines in their possession. So part of the, and he gave me these notebooks, Yederong gave them to me to research. So it became my project. So part of the book is going to be, or I don't know if it's going to be a book, I shouldn't be presumptuous, or part of the project is going to be like a micro history. Of this temple and the ecology of the horse king temple, of the village from which the manuscript hail. So that's part of it. But perhaps part of it will also be, like the Nerja project, will be more of a literary and historical project on the tantric origins and all the legends and lore of this horse king and how they are related to Indian mythology.
I see. Wow, that sounds fascinating.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, okay, well, we will look for your book this year, And then hopefully look for another book on horses a few years down the road. Anyway, thank you very much for speaking with me today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in.
And thank you.
That's it for today's New Books in Buddhist Studies. See you next time.